initiatives that are going on now, everything's becoming automated. And now you've got to start worrying about, okay, who's going to hack it? And what is that going to do to my control system?
There will always be somebody stronger, faster, and smarter than you. Surviving depends on your adaptability to change. Those who are the most adaptable are dialed in. Going down a tech rabbit hole here, but like open source is driving innovation, right? Like if it's open source, more people have access to it. And that's where true innovation is really lying. So that's what Chris Wood has done. He's a fellow at Lockheed Martin. That's what he's passionate about. That's what he's done over his tenure at Lockheed. So let's bring up Chris Wood and get into the show. Hey, Chris, welcome to the show. You're on the air with us.
Good morning or good afternoon, I guess it is, in Houston.
It's a middle of the day, right? Both work.
That's right.
So, Chris, you know, on this show, we talk about being the most adaptable to change. And obviously, you've had quite a career with Lockheed. You're a fellow at Lockheed, PhD, CISSP. We were just joking about, you said when you went for your PhD, they said there will be a quiz at the end. And there definitely was. So why don't you set the stage for us, set the context a little bit about your story, who you are, and, you know, what you're most dialed into, what you're most passionate about.
Well, I've been working at Lockheed off and on since I was first in college. I worked the night shift in Los Angeles, in Burbank and Palmdale, California, on the L-1011 and the P-3 programs as a structural assembler while I was going to school. And that was kind of my first joint endeavor with Lockheed, shall we say. And I've been now with them for 40 plus years, and it's been quite an exciting ride. I've had a lot of interesting programs and things that I've worked on, and I was accidentally inserted into the open source world about 17 years ago with the company when the vice president of engineering and legal department decided that it was time that we develop a tool so that we could actually understand the licensing and whatnot that goes with being able to use open source software. And of course, it's grown in its popularity over the last 17 years, and it's really skyrocketed in engineering development for us over the last 3 or 4 years. So it's becoming more and more important to what we do, especially on the ground-based and the enterprise type systems for the company. We don't use open source as much in our deliverable products, but it's starting to grow because it's incorporated by so many of the COT software vendors now as part of their product.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's posed another problem in itself, trying to identify what the licensing is in their products.
So, yeah. So what do you think is the most fascinating element to open source? I mean, what draws you to it?
Because it's so challenging to not only do the cybersecurity part of it, of detecting the vulnerabilities in it early before you actually bring it into the company and introduce it, and then continuously having to monitor it to see what kind of exploits have been developed since you introduced it into the company and what kind of vulnerabilities you have to look out for and either patch or get rid of the software and replace it.
Right. What's one of the kind of the wildest examples you can give us of that?
We've found software. I've looked at software that has so many vulnerabilities in it that have date back so far in their history that it's almost inconceivable that they haven't patched them. Quite a few of the software foundations in the larger development organizations that exist out there, if you formally report a bug via their bug reporting capabilities, they will address the vulnerabilities. But there are some organizations out there that kind of tell you, well, that's in somebody else's module that we're using, so go away.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can't tell you the countless, like I just had one yesterday, NDA and everything, but, you know, Windows Server 2003, like, you know, it's constantly, you know, that constantly cat and mouse game of upgrading and protecting yourself from vulnerabilities, right? And everyone's at a different stage of the game, it seems like, right. Even now, right? So, so you know what? First of all, like taking a step back again, you know, how did you get involved in the aerospace business? Are you a pilot? Obviously, you have to have a love and desire for planes, or maybe you don't. But you know, I think you do, right?
I certainly do. Actually, my father was in the Air Force, and he worked for the Jet Propulsion Lab out in the desert at the Edwards Air Force Base test facility. And he worked on a lot of the early X planes that came up right at the end of the World War II and the beginning of the Korean War timeframe. And so as a very young child, I got to go out to the base with him occasionally and watch the aircraft fly or do live engine runs. And it just really excited me. So I learned to fly. I've been flying for more than 40 years now. And it's kind of keeps me connected with what I do at work, because I know that the end result of what we do at work in a software development field is going to end up in a product with somebody flying it just like I do. And they're going to be relying on the software that we're putting into their aircraft to control it. And as you know, with the artificial intelligence initiatives that are going on now, everything's becoming automated. And now you've got to start worrying about, okay, who's going to hack it? And what is that going to do to my control system? So it's been pretty interesting.
Right. And I feel like, it's funny for me to say I feel like, because I'm not a pilot, nor have I ever had training in it. But to me, it seems like being a pilot has trained you very well for cybersecurity. There's probably tons of parallels there with, you know, you got to kind of be ready for anything as a pilot. Like chaos is like you're just waiting for chaos to ensue, right? So, and similar in a cybersecurity realm, like, you know, you're planning for that. You're planning for the worst case scenarios oftentimes, right?
Yes, absolutely. And it's funny because we've been had to introduce new avionics equipment into our aircraft that we fly in for ADS-B. So that everybody else knows where we are. And if we had a receiver, we could see where the other aircraft are because they're transmitting. And so we had to take the airplane out and test fly it to demonstrate to the FAA that our ADS-B receiver and transmitter were working properly. So we went out on the test flight and we flew the test patterns and came back and landed. And the FAA came back and said, well, your test failed. What do you mean it failed? Well, it interrupted itself several times during the flight. Well, what we ended up explaining to them was that during the flight, there were some aerobatics that were undertaken and the airplane went upside down a couple of times. And because the ADS-B antennas are all on the bottom of the airplane, because it's a ground-based system, it lost track and it didn't know where we were. So we had to go out and repeat the ground track for them and subsequently passed. But it's kind of interesting to see how different types of test environments, if they're not fully specified, will leave openings that somebody has to unintentionally explore to the world. So,
that's fascinating. I mean, I was just talking about this earlier today with somebody. I mean, you know, being able to like test and experiment, like almost like in real time, like in the action, right? Like even Lockheed, I mean, even you guys have done that. And yeah, sometimes you're going to fail. And that's just kind of part of the risk you take, right? Which ties into cybersecurity, right? There's a level of risk. There's some tolerance to that. There's understanding. And then there's, you know, either we do something about it or we don't, but at least we know that there's risk there, right?
Yes. And I think that some of the commercial space companies that are now coming online and launching rockets and landing their boosters back on the same place where they took off from. You know, it's all very interesting. And the challenges that it presents is that from an aerospace industry, you're actually working in more dimensions than you are if you're just programming AI into a car or a truck or a train. So you've got to think of all of those things. And then think about what are the implications if this happens versus that happens, and how do I need to test for it differently? And that's exactly the process we had to go through with our own airplanes with the ADS-B system and the FAA, was we had to go figure out, okay, why did it go wrong? What were we doing? And what do we need to do differently so that we can pass the test or see from a technical perspective that it passed the test?
Oh, yeah, no, that's fascinating. Side note question that just came to me because we're talking about this. What are your thoughts on the U.S. Space Force? And I'm not talking about the Netflix show, although that's hilarious, but what are your thoughts on the actual U.S. Space Force?
I would love to join the Space Force if I was young enough.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. Because coming from your Air Force background, right? Like the Space Force is like that next frontier. I mean, obviously.
Right. So, yeah. So the Space Force was just the next step up. I mean, I watched the X-15 fly. I watched the last Bell X-5 fly. And I watched, I actually was working for NASA as a summer intern while I was in college, working on one of the lifting body programs. I was teamed up with a master's student in electrical engineering from, where'd he go to school? He was from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and we were teamed up to develop and breadboard and build and do complete environmental and electrical testing on a piece of flight test gear that was going to go into one of those lifting bodies. And when we got done running all of those tests, we actually went outside and stood on the concrete ramp at NASA and watched the B-52 fly over and drop the lifting body and watched it come down and land. So Wow. It was kind of an end-to-end test.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm going to ask you a difficult question here. Well, what is your favorite aircraft? What is your most favorite aircraft?
Probably the Corsair.
Corsair?
Yeah,
World War II. Can you describe that for us? For those of us, some of the, like me, I'm not familiar at all.
It's a big Navy based, and the Marine Corps also used it quite effectively. Carrier type airplane. It had gull shaped wings. I don't know if you ever saw Baba Black Sheep. There was a TV series it was on back in the 50s and 60s. Anyway, those were Corsairs, and they're big, usually painted blue. And there was a single pilot, and it had a big radial engine up front, made lots of cool noise, and it went really fast. And you could shoot down zeros with it.
And what was the purpose of it? To shoot down zeros? That was the purpose of that one?
It was primarily a fighter interceptor type aircraft, but it also delivered bombs and rockets when it needed to.
Oh, awesome. Awesome. All right, cool. What would you say is the most exciting project or program you've ever worked on?
The most exciting project that I ever worked on is probably the space shuttle program. Okay. I was involved with that when we were building the first orbiters. And I worked primarily an engineering liaison task and with tooling. And I designed and built a lot of the tooling that they used to assemble the spacecraft. And then I actually went onto the aircraft and created red line drawings to show the engineers that on the second and third orbiters, this is what you designed, and this is how it actually fit when the mechanics went to install it on the aircraft. And then we got to watch again all of the initial actual air testing of it and the first launch. So it was quite an exciting program. I spent quite a bit of time in the orbiter cockpit as we got all the instrumentation and everything hooked up and ran all the controls to run this end-to-end system tests. So it was pretty fun.
And that was the first orbiter?
Yes.
Wow. That's incredible. That's incredible to have been part of that. Do you still keep in touch with people on that team?
No, most of them retired quite a while ago. So no, and that was with Rockwell International that I was working with. And of course, Rockwell's been assimilated by Boeing. Yep. And I work for Lockheed. So
yeah,
the people that worked for them on that program ended up working for Boeing.
Yeah, we weren't supposed to say the B word today.
That's okay. I don't have any heartburn with Boeing. I've worked with them on programs for quite a number of years. And so I know a lot of people that work up there.
Awesome. 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 And so throughout that, you've been part of like large scale software development programs, right? So can you maybe kind of share some of the things you've learned as a leadership role, as a mentor in those leadership positions in the software development programs you've led?
I think over the years, we've transitioned so much from, we were originally doing waterfall software development, and then we moved into the spiral software development, and now we're moving into agile software development. But at the same time that we've been going through that, we've also been going through a large scale change in our approach to dealing with the employees and giving them more autonomy and actually listening to their contributions. Whereas when I first started working there, it was, it was more like, shut up, Tiger. If I want to hear from you, I'll talk to you. And so the young people's contributions weren't valued, and I didn't feel valued. So I've tried to carry that forward with me in my career, so that as I became a supervisor and then a manager and so forth and progressed on up through CIO, I always tried to listen to the people as they were talking to me to understand what their perspective was and what they were offering that we could actually integrate and use to better our approach. And that's become so much more important now with agile software development. I think the term that's currently in vogue is you're now a servant leader rather than a taskmaster.
A taskmaster? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard that before too. So what other roles in the business do you play outside of your place of employment? So, what does being a fellow at Lockheed, what does that entail? What does that mean?
Simplistically, it means that I've been doing my job for so long and I've got such a breadth of experience and I do it so well that I'm in the top 1% of the engineers in the company. Or, give yourself a real small percentage there. And that's kind of where we are. You have to make an application to become a fellow, and you have to diagram and explain all of your breadth of experience and all the things that you've done from a technical perspective. And then you're either selected and nominated to become a fellow or you're not.
Wow. That's really competitive. Is this comparable to like a Tiger team of sorts, or are there various Tiger teams within that?
Because individually and collectively we can be called to assist on new proposals or big problems that they're having on a program in one of the business areas and contribute our special skills towards solving the problems. So we do form Tiger teams based on the skill sets that are required to solve the problems.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. What are some key things you've learned in kind of that process, and how long has that been going on for you?
I've been doing it for about 3 years now, and it's been really exciting because I've got to meet an awful lot of other very smart people who have skills in other companion areas and non-adjacent areas. So one of the areas that I got very interested in just as an association through this fellows program is with quantum computing. And so I'm starting to pursue that as something that I want to build up my skills in so that I'm competent at it.
Oh yeah. Quantum computing. Those are the next mainframes of yesterday, right? Right now. right?
Yes.
Yeah. Crazy stuff going on there with Quibbits and on all that stuff. Talk to Eric Yancey over at City of Irvine, Irving, and I'll tell you all about that, right?
Oh, I listened in on that podcast.
Did you? Yeah. That was good stuff. He's fascinated with that whole realm as well. You know, as you are mentoring others, right? You've done some mentoring with like future engineers and scientists, and like that seems from an outside looking in, that might seem like out of scope of an IT leader. But can you maybe explain kind of how that fits into your purview?
Well, I was an engineer before I was an IT person, and I kind of slipped into that through the back door with my studies in my PhD program, and I ended up writing and developing a knowledge management program while I was doing my PhD work and presenting it at a conference. And I got pulled more and more into the IT world. And that's when I became a CIO for one of our major $60 billion programs. And so I ran that whole program, but I kind of started out as a systems engineer, supporting our sustaining airplanes. In other words, the aircraft that are already out in the field and they're flying, in solving the problems that they had from an engineering perspective, working them with the design team to make sure that we incorporated that knowledge into the design for future aircraft, as well as designing and fixing the problems that they had out there at the Air Force base. So, and then I went overseas. I was a site manager in that venue for 3 years. And then I came back and I was a principal engineer over a team of systems engineers that had all of the systems on the F-16 aircraft that we were building at the time. Well, we're still building them, but that was a while ago. And so I had all of the mechanical and electrical systems on the airplane were the engineers that were under my perspective. So I did that for a number of years before I actually started getting into the computing side of it. Although all the time that I was doing the systems engineering stuff, I was pushing the company real hard to incorporate the first IBM computers, because we had some TRS-80s and we didn't like those too much. They were good for the bean counters, but they didn't work too well for us.
Got it. Well, moving right along then. Raymond says, what possibilities or impacts do you see of quantum computing on cybersecurity, for example, around encryption? That's a great, well thought out question. Thank you, Raymond.
Yeah, that's one of the questions that I've specifically been taking a look at. And I think that from my recent conversations and research that I've done, that we're still a ways down the road from being able to have, we may be able to come up with some interesting keys using a quantum computer, but the problem is, how do you distribute those huge keys to very small devices? So I think that for right now, I think it's certainly in the future. And for right now, we keep needing to pursue how we create keys, what those keys actually look like, and do they look like anything like an RSA algorithm or a Shor's algorithm? And if they do, then how do you fit that so that you can use it on both ends of a system that aren't necessarily running a quantum computer? Because right now, quantum computing, those computers are so heavy and so power hungry, and they require such cold temperatures for most of them to work well, they're pretty useless for aerospace vehicles.
Mm. Sounds like IoT, quantum computing, blockchain, a couple other things, like they're on a collision course at some point in the future here. Definitely.
Yeah, I think so. From an encryption standpoint, I would definitely agree with that. Because once you can do the encryption, then you can do the opposite of that, and then you can start looking into things. And once you can start looking into things, then is blockchain safe anymore?
Right.
Is that cryptocurrency that's in there, how well are you going to be able to go in there and mine it using quantum computers to help you figure out where it is and what account it's in?
Yeah.
I think that there's some real challenges out there for future cybersecurity use.
It'll definitely be fascinating to watch. So Chris, as we're wrapping up here, just a few more questions and then I'll turn back to you for just some final words. But, what is it in your career that just makes you feel like your best self? Like, what are those moments? Can you share one with us?
I think that my best moments are moments where I've been assigned to go do something, or I see something that I think could be done in a different way, and someone empowers me to be able to go after it. And when I finish the project, it works really well, just like I hoped it would. And I'm able to demonstrate that to people and also show that along the way, I've had these other younger people, younger engineers with less time in their career field, learning how to do what I just did that they can then pick it up and they can carry it forward.
Absolutely.
Because that's always been my biggest concern is leaving a job, whether it was changing a position or changing a company, and leaving a big hole there because I didn't train someone. And I don't think that that's what we owe the companies that we work for. I think we really owe them that continuity so that you're kind of like that bucket of water where you can stick your hand in it, pull it out, and the bucket's still full.
Chris, what is the single best book you've ever read or would recommend to others?
I really think that it would probably be some of the linear algebra and I hate to say this out loud, type books that I used as study references when I was going to college. And the fact that I've still got some of those old textbooks hanging around, because you just never know when somebody's going to give you a problem and you go, you know, if only I could remember how to do that. Because you become so dependent on using your textbook approaches to designing something. And everybody wants everything back a few years ago when I was designing hardware, they all wanted mil-spec hardware. So you memorized all the mil-specs and you knew what they all were. And when you came upon the need for something, you go, oh yeah, that's a mil. And you go look it up in the catalog, you know the specs, and you just plug it right in. And now it's come back to the point where, and let's take cyber computing for quantum computing in the cybersecurity world as an example. If you're not real strong in your linear algebra and how to apply it and how to work that, you're going to be sunk. So since I've become reinterested in quantum computing as it becomes something more than science fiction, I've had to go back and start brushing up my skills in linear algebra. And I haven't touched linear algebra as looking at it from that standpoint for quite a few years.
Wow, fascinating. Get that knowledge, right? Build the frameworks, the foundation to be a good sound engineer on.
Right. That's like going back to your old handy dandy Fundamentals of C Computing book or your database system book and pulling it down off the shelf and saying, gosh, I'm glad I kept that thing.
Absolutely. So what is the single best piece of advice you've ever received or given to anyone?
I think the best piece of advice that I've ever received, and certainly I've passed it along to especially some of the younger kids. I volunteer when they're having STEM projects at some of the local schools to work with them to grade their projects and give them constructive advice and feedback. And it's always to keep an open mind to what you've done and then be willing to accept input from someone who may know more or may know a little bit different about the subject that you're working with, and be able to incorporate those changes and to make your product better in the end. And that's one thing that I've always tried to do with the young people that we mentor in some of these STEM projects. I've got a big STEM school right down the street that they just built, and I'm going to go over there after they get back to school full time and ask them if they've got a STEM program there that we can work with, because they're just right around the corner from my house, and I can go there and participate with them after school and I get off work.
Excellent. Keep an open mind, be open-minded, and be able to communicate to people that, you know, may or may not have more or less knowledge or experience than you. Definitely some wise words. Chris, I appreciate the time today. It flew. Parting piece of guidance, last words, what else do you want to say that we didn't say yet?
I think the one thing that I would suggest to everyone is to, in your chosen field where you have your best specialties, is to work with the young students, because the United States has obviously lost the edge in the STEM subject. And it's kind of disheartening when I talk to some of the middle school teachers now and some of the high school teachers who are saying, the kids just don't get it. And we don't understand why they're in this class, because they can barely read functionally. And I'm going, holy mackerel. So work with the kids, any kid that's interested, young boys, young girls, especially young women, and get them interested in staying in school and studying those STEM subjects, because they can make a wonderful career for themselves and a wonderful contribution to this country.
Thanks for listening to Dialed In. This show is brought to you by Acuerdo.io, the world's first orchestration agency for the future of work. Go check us out at Acuerdo.io. This show could also not be put together without great partners, Robin Austin and Casey Yarbrough of Elevate Exchange, membership for IT leaders. And remember, to win in life, to win in business, to win in your career, it's not about being the strongest, the fastest, or the smartest, simply about being the most adaptable to change, the most dialed in.